As the Trump administration begins to wrap up its defense, is the Bolton book looking like a tipping point in the impeachment saga? A closer look today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown in the Texas Standard Newsroom. A Texas A&M constitutional scholar weighs in on what happens next in the Senate trial of Donald J. Trump. Also, a plan to reboot space exploration gets kicked to the sidewalk. A step forward for Boeing, but some say a giant leap backward for U.S. space exploration. Also, the ongoing issue of migrant family separation that few are talking about. All that and a whole lot more when the Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this Tuesday, January 28th, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Anyone out there a fan of contemporary musicals? Well, maybe a few of you can sing along to this one. No one really knows how the game is played, the art of the trade, how the sausage gets made. We just assume that it happens, but no one else is in the room where it happens, Bolton claims. Okay, I took a little liberty with those last two words, but the musical Hamilton is all about liberty, is it not? Former National Security Advisor John Bolton took some liberties of his own in naming his new Trump tell-all book for the Hamilton song, The Room Where It Happened. In it, Bolton says the president told him that frozen Ukraine aid would be restored only if officials in Ukraine announced an investigation into Joe Biden and his son, which is the main thrust of the allegation Democrats have leveled at the president in his impeachment. Bolton's book hasn't been released, mind you, but over the weekend, the New York Times revealed the pertinent allegations, thereby putting more pressure on Republicans in control of the Senate and, therefore, in control of the impeachment trial itself. But at least three Senate Republicans, including Utah's Mitt Romney, Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, and Maine Senator Susan Collins, seem open to asking Bolton to stop on by and say a few words about his new book to the Senate in an appearance that would likely be more formal than, say, an interview on a late-night TV show. Indeed, could the Bolton revelations prove to be a tipping point in the impeachment trial? Lynn Rambo is a constitutional law scholar at Texas A&M University School of Law. Professor, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me, David.
President Trump's defense team wrapping up today, or that's the expectation. What do we expect from the third and final day? What would you tell the defense team that they need to do?
Well, the interesting aspect is the new development in terms of John Bolton's book or the report on the book. You know, many of the senators have become concerned that revelations in Bolton's book are going to support the idea that the president conditioned the aid to Ukraine on the announcement of an investigation. And they're now worried that if they proceed in the theory that that didn't happen and the book says otherwise and can prove it, they will look poorly in the light of history.
So do you think that means that they will vote to ask John Bolton to testify in this trial?
Well, those seem to be reports. You know, it's really difficult to get into the senators' heads who are somewhat in the middle. But the reports are suggesting that that concerns them. It's setting up a really interesting soap opera because they're, to the extent that the more moderate senators decide they want Bolton to testify, mm-hmm. there's going to be pressure from Trump supporters to bring in Biden and or Hunter Biden. And so there's the possibility of sort of a game of chicken in terms of, you know, we will grant you the right to have Bolton as long as you agree to permit Biden to testify. And you can kind of see something developing where the Democrats won't agree to that and or Biden won't agree. And the Republicans shake their head and say, well, we wanted to call more witnesses, but we were unable to.
Yeah. Yesterday, Alan Dershowitz laid out the constitutional weaknesses of the case against Trump. And I'm curious, since you're a constitutional law scholar, if you had a chance to catch any of that and what you might make of it.
Yes, I'm familiar with the position that Alan Dershowitz is now taking, which is, of course, different than he took many years ago. He's cutting against the majority of constitutional law scholars with respect to whether or not a criminal offense per se is required by the Constitution.
He's saying that that the Constitution demands it.
Yes, by virtue of the reference to treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. But if you look back at the history behind the ratification of the Constitution and the discussion at the convention debates, it's pretty clear, and you can look at Federalist Number 65, that they were not talking about high crimes and misdemeanors as you and I might think of those. They were using that term to mean something more serious than just maladministration. Literally, one of the framers proposed that maladministration, which is would mean poor administration by the president, would be enough to remove him. And the other framers disagreed with that and thought it needed to be more of an offense against the public trust. But it seems to me pretty clear that if they had wanted a the actual elements of a criminal offense, they would have said that, and that is nowhere at all in the constitutional debates.
High crimes and misdemeanors don't qualify as detailed enough?
They did not discuss it in those terms, and that term is from British common law and is not necessarily thought of in the meaning that you and I would put to high crimes and misdemeanors. It's kind of a catch-all term for offenses against the public trust.
If the Senate does decide, we're going to call witnesses because this John Bolton thing is just too explosive, then what?
Yep.
I mean, what does the process look like?
Well, you know, that in and of itself is unclear because of what I was just talking about in terms of their being able to dictate their own procedure. You know, normally you would have witnesses called by the prosecution first. So witnesses representing the House's case would go first, and then any witnesses the defense would want to call would go next. And actually, in the existing Senate rules, that is provided for. The problem is that the existing Senate rules can be changed at any time by a majority vote of the Senate.
Lynn,
so it's a little unclear what it's going to look like.
Lynn, do you think anyone's still paying attention, or you think this is more of a partisan thing right now? I mean, you know, the Republicans watching the defense and the Democrats watching the setup.
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I don't have the sense that a whole lot of people are tuning into the proceedings. So it's really hard to say. I myself am having to, you know, I have a job, so I have to watch in the evenings on YouTube with the Washington Post replay. But I think it's about to get a little more interesting because the Bolton material is going to put people in a little bit of a box that they were not necessarily anticipating. So that may change.
Lynn Rambo is constitutional law professor and scholar at Texas A&M University School of Law. Lynn, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Oh, you bet.
Those who think your vote doesn't count are invited to take note of the next item. Months after more than 22,000 ballots were cast in the biggest bond initiative ever undertaken by the city of Midland, total of more than $500 million to build two new high schools. We should note this is the Midland Independent School District. A judge now says the measure has failed by a whopping 26 votes. This after a roller coaster of counts and recounts and recriminations. Marfa Public Radio's Mitch Borden has more.
Four?
Yes.
For all the emotion and drama of the past few months, Midland's bond saga came to a quiet end. A little over a week ago, a half dozen volunteers huddled around two tables in the Midland County Commissioner's courtroom for one final tally of 837 votes that had previously been lost.
Against? Against? Four?
Midland County election officials had misplaced the majority of these ballots after Election Day in November and only realized it after a hand recount came up hundreds of votes short. The recount also found the bond passed when previously it had failed, both by razor-slim margins. Trey Traynor is an elections attorney.
It's important that when people do participate in the process, that the rules are followed. And that's the problem that you have here, is that there were rules that weren't followed.
In this case, Traynor represented opponents of the multi-million-dollar bond in an election challenge. After the missing ballot box was found, bond advocates and adversaries agreed that the courts needed to get involved.
Against? Against?
Once volunteers finished counting up these ballots, everyone present came to the same conclusion. The bond had failed. But local officials say this contentious and confusing election wasn't all for nothing. Russell Malm, Midland County's lawyer, says the mistakes made exposed important issues.
Better training was needed, some better procedures, some better chain of custody forms. So there were really just a few things, and I think we've corrected those.
Though Malm admits it may take some time before the county rebuilds locals' trust in elections. That tracks with what people both for and against the bond have told me. After this botched process, many people I've interviewed say they can't completely trust Midland elections. But some do take comfort in the fact that the county's new voting machines weren't responsible for all this trouble. Christine Foreman led the charge for the bond campaign. She says although this initiative was rejected by voters, it doesn't change the fact that Midland needs more schools for its exploding student population.
We know that the need is there. We know that the capacity needs for our community are there. What this means is just getting a group together and coming to the same table and coming up with a bond that more of the community can come around and support.
Foreman wishes the bond election wasn't plagued by so many issues, but she says after all the ups and downs of the past few months, hopefully this experience will ensure the integrity of future elections. I'm Mitch Borden in Midland.
Joining us once again to talk about what Texans are talking about, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. We're hearing from our friends and listeners about the story at the top of the show, the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump and whether the Republican-controlled U.S. Senate will call witnesses. Yes, chief among them, former Trump advisor John Bolton, who, as we all know, says he was directly informed of the president's plan to release Ukraine aid in exchange for an investigation into the Biden family. On Facebook, Charles Scott writes, "The fact that we are even discussing the possibility of witnesses is completely absurd. The primary element in any trial is evidence in the form of documents and testimony. We are witnessing a cover-up, plain and simple," Charles says. And here's what Robert Stevens says about the actions of the Republican senators like Mitt Romney and Susan Collins, those Republican senators who say they're interested in having Bolton testify. "Two words," Robert writes, "plausible deniability. They both want to be seen as moderates, even though they both already went along and voted for no witnesses, and they'll do it again," he predicts. Lots of back and forth, not even over testimony at this point, but whether or not they'll get their hands on that transcript of the unpublished book that Bolton wrote where these allegations are written down.
You know, a tantalizing prospect is that the Republicans say okay to John Bolton, but on the condition that Joe Biden, right, testify.
Right.
I wonder what Texans think about that back and forth. Is that fair? I mean, is that the way that this game should be played or not so much? Tweet us. Let us know. You just reach out to us on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar looking for you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The headlines may have moved on, but not everyone's forgotten the recent drama with Iran. From San Antonio, Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports on the veterans and activists who gathered outside Lackland Air Force Base over the weekend.
Less than a month ago, a U.S. drone strike killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, ratcheting up tensions between Washington and Tehran. The Trump administration has since imposed new sanctions on the country. In response, some 30 protesters met Saturday at the Lackland Corridor Gateway Memorial. They spoke against the possibility of war with Iran and demanded the withdrawal of American troops from neighboring Iraq. Jules Vaquera is a former airman and a member of About Face, Veterans Against the War.
What's great is right next to this monument for Lackland, there's a giant sign that says, "End the wars, end the sanctions, end the occupations." Big group of people are standing here speaking, making art, and generally standing together in solidarity against war.
Vaquera spoke over a PA system about the costs of conflict and her own experiences fighting in Iraq.
"I've had enough violence and hate and killing. I have definitely had enough of those to last a lifetime. I've had enough of rich people sending poor people's children to die." Woo!
When protester Courtney Marhev learned about the drone strike that killed General Soleimani, she imagined what would come next.
I just thought, here we go.
She says she thinks the U.S. government and its unelected influencers have been set on attacking Iran for a long time.
And so I think they're finally trying to find their excuse. I think it's financially motivated.
Protester Giovanni Reyes says tougher sanctions on Iran could have unintended consequences.
The whole intent behind the sanctions, which Mike Pompeo calls maximum pressure, is to push forward the collapse of the Iranian economy. And not only going to hurt a lot of people, it's going to push people to leave the country, right? And when people leave the country, then they become refugees in other people's country, right?
Others like Mustafa Ali worried about how conflict with Iran might lead to financial instability at home.
You know, if we go to war, you know, we're all going to hurt. And already economically, a lot of us are struggling to stay in the middle class or just the working poor. So the future of the economic, you know, of course, the oil prices, so many things that's going to hurt that we don't see but will reveal itself if we do go to war.
Saturday's gathering was part of a global day of protest against war in Iran. Some 25 cities participated. Future demonstrations are planned for San Antonio in the spring. Within the wider community, there is support for the Trump administration's recent actions in Iran. A new poll by the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research found that 41% of Americans approved of the decision to order a drone strike on Soleimani. 30% disapproved, while the rest didn't express an opinion. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. According to Bloomberg Businessweek, Oprah's book club is the single greatest outside influence on sales in the marketplace for new books. In a video announcing the book American Dirt as her next book club pick, Ms. Winfrey says, "From the first page, the first sentence I was in, I was open, I was shook up." And she goes on to say, "It woke me up, and I feel that everybody who reads this book is actually going to be immersed in the experience of what it means to be a migrant on the run for freedom," close quote. Though some have called it a grapes of wrath for our times, others have decided the book relies on stereotypes to paint an inauthentic picture of Mexican migrants, exploiting trauma and pain for profit. And American Dirt has become the latest political Rorschach test, some believe. For her part, the director of the McAllen Public Library, Kate Horan, has declined to be a part of an Oprah Book Club promotion of the book American Dirt. And Kate Horan joins us now to talk about that. Ms. Horan, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me, David.
Tell us a little bit about your involvement here with this promotion. Oprah's Book Club was what, going to send you some books, or what were they going to do exactly?
So this is a new initiative between the American Library Association and Oprah's Book Club to involve public libraries more in Oprah's Book Club by identifying different libraries to receive multiple copies of the book, like any book club. When I was first asked to be part of this, I was very, very excited. I mean, it's Oprah. And I thought, this is great for my library. Here we are 10 miles from the border with Mexico, is going to be on national TV, maybe. They said, and this is the Oprah people, they said, "We want you to have an unboxing ceremony and videotape it." So I said, fine. So then when I got it was one box of books. I opened it, and that's when I saw, this is going to be a problem, because I already know too many negative things about it and already don't feel that this would be something that I could get behind.
Do you feel like it would be an endorsement of the book, it sounds like?
Yes. And really, that's what they want us to do, is to endorse the book. And I felt like, well, they picked us, McAllen, for a reason, because we're on the border. I don't know, and I still don't know what other libraries were chosen. But I was told that libraries in the quote unquote American Southwest were selected to be part of this. You know, I had to make a decision. Do I go with this or do I not?
Mm-hmm.
Because if I were to accept the partnership, then it would be very offensive to the people in the community that I serve and represent.
Let me stop you right here, because there are going to be listeners who are not going to understand what the controversy is about. Why is this a problematic book, to use your words?
I've read the book, and it is full of like a Hollywoodized version of a migrant story, as if you were to take like every horrible fantasy that you could think of about the migrant experience and stitch a bunch of headlines together, and that would be this book. It's over the top, it's stereotypes, and it gets a lot of things wrong.
She could have gotten sensitivity readers to read it over and to point out where she's inaccurate or where she gets dialogue wrong, for instance. But I think they were banking on the zeitgeist of the pulse of the country after the 2016 election. Well, the headlines are there. People could read about it in the newspaper, but they want to read this story and read about brown people suffering.
Is this book going to be available to check out at your library?
Yeah, I think one of the important things is that, you know, in the library world, we don't select based on our personal taste. You know, I want to point out that I did decline the offer to be part of the Oprah's Book Club, but I do have multiple copies that are available for checkout. They're going to circulate just like, you know, any other book would circulate.
Let me ask you about the other side of this. I mean, it's not like the McAllen Public Library has unlimited resources, and saying no to a force like Oprah's Book Club, could this make it harder for your library to participate in other programs like this?
I don't think so. Based on the responses that I've gotten, which have been very, very positive, I think people have respect for the library and the decision that I made along with my staff, the integrity of that decision. And actually, to the contrary, I'm already getting different offers and recognition and talking about different partnerships. So This was the right thing for us to do.
Kate Horan is the director of the McAllen Public Library, and she has declined to participate with Oprah's Book Club in the promotion of the book American Dirt. Ms. Horan, thank you so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. We appreciate it.
Thank you, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where horned frogs strive to be a force for the greater good. Stories of TCU faculty, student, and alumni changemakers can be explored online at leadon.tcu.edu. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology. With more than 210 cancer centers across the state, patients can access technology, research, and treatment options in their local communities. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Advocacy groups in Texas are urging low-income immigrant families to keep using public benefits their U.S. citizen relatives are eligible for, despite a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court Monday. The justices narrowly voted to allow the Trump administration to move forward with its so-called public charge rule while legal challenges are resolved in court. The policy makes it harder for immigrants who use or may need certain types of government assistance to eventually get a green card. Ann Dunkelberg is with the left-leaning Center for Public Policy Priorities. She explains misinformation surrounding the rule has led families in Texas to drop out of public benefits.
We know that we've seen since 2017 a decline in children participating in our Medicaid and CHIP programs, and we've also seen a decline in families participating in the SNAP program, formerly what we used to call food stamps.
More than one in four Texas children has a parent who is not a U.S. citizen. Today is election day for three special runoff races to fill seats in the Texas House. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more.
In Dallas, Texas House District 100 has two Democratic contenders vying to replace a seat left vacant by Eric Johnson after he became the city's mayor. The other two races are in the Houston area. House District 148 has a Democrat and Republican facing off against each other to replace Democrat Jessica Farrar, who stepped down in September. But it's House District 28 that's grabbing the most attention, with Democrats vowing to flip the district blue. It's been long held by Republicans, most recently former State Representative John Zerwas, who served in the House for the past 12 years. That race is between Democrat Eliz Markowitz and Republican Gary Gates, who appears to be leading so far among early voters. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
State and federal officials are giving the public the opportunity to again weigh in on proposed plans to help the Texas coast withstand future storms. The Coastal Texas Study also addresses ways to restore local ecosystems. Karina Erickson is with the Texas General Land Office, which is working with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on the study.
One of the best things that the study is doing is coming in and restoring some of our wetlands and restoring our dunes and providing beach nourishment.
Erickson says once the study is finalized, it will head to Congress for approval. A series of public meetings kick off next month, starting February 8th on High Island. And the U.S. Treasury Department will mint coins honoring President George H.W. Bush and his wife Barbara this year. President Trump signed legislation Monday to issue the coinage for the former commander-in-chief and first lady, who both died in 2018. They are buried at Bush's Presidential Library in College Station. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Changes could be on the horizon for the space program that could alter the trajectory for plans to put humans back on the moon. On Friday, the House Science Committee introduced a NASA authorization bill that shifts the focus away from the Artemis program, which was proposed by the Trump administration. That program aimed to put humans back on the moon as one small step toward Mars. Joining us now is Eric Berger. He covers all things space for Ars Technica. Eric, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
First, can you just give us a primer on what authorization acts like H.R. 5666 do? This is not actually doling out money for a specific project, right?
No, that's correct. In Congress, you've got two different types of committees. There are the authorizers who sort of lay out the policy, the will, the sense of Congress, if you will. And then there are the appropriators who actually specify the budgets for different programs. And authorizers and appropriators don't always agree. And so you're never quite sure what an agency is going to get. But in this case, H.R. 5666 does lay out a pretty clear path for NASA. And if adopted, it would be a pretty significant change.
The significance of this change, it's a little hard to understate, to be honest, because it seems like what this does is it returns us to square one, where, I mean, you describe it as some people saying this is the Boeing bill. It sort of puts Boeing back in the driver's seat for the next generation of space exploration, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting. In some sense, it's kind of a backward-looking bill. It sort of returns us to a failed policy of a decade ago where NASA kind of set its sights on Mars, and we kind of spun our wheels for a while and never really got anywhere. The new administration has come in, and they've actually taken a pretty forward look at things and said, look, a realistic near-term goal is the moon. We've got international partners that want to go there. We've got commercial space companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin that can help us out. We ought to try to get everyone on board and make a push toward the moon.
I think some listeners would say, why go to the moon? We've already been there.
And that's a great question. There are a number of reasons. First of all, it is something that we can do in the near term. It's not a goal 10, 15, 20 years down the line. When we have these horizon goals for NASA, we found in the past that they tend to just slip away. The programs get canceled just because we don't show any tangible progress toward getting there. The other reason is that, you know, China is going to go to the moon within the next decade. And the question is, do we really want to let them have free reign so close to Earth on kind of the closest satellite to our planet?
I suppose we should remind folks, if they weren't paying attention to the Artemis plan, the idea here would be that NASA would be in partnership, as you were saying, with SpaceX and with Blue Origin, some of the private contractors, establish a footprint on the moon once again. It sounds like maybe do a little bit of resource exploitation there up on the moon, maybe some mining or something along those lines?
Yeah, one of the interesting things that we found out since going to Apollo, when the astronauts went there in the 1960s and 70s, they found a very dead, dry world. Since then, based upon some scientific probes, scientists are pretty confident that in the permanently shadowed regions, so these are craters at the north and south pole of the moon, there's probably ice. And so the thinking is that you could go there and have a source of water already on hand. If you break it down, you could make rocket fuel out of that and do other things and have a basis for some kind of a moon base or colony going forward. And so the idea was to go there and kind of explore around those polar regions and see what could happen and learn skills needed to live on a world other than Mars and then use that knowledge to eventually go on to Mars.
So sort of as a stepstone toward Mars. But now this new authorization
What does it mean to be returning to the old way of thinking about NASA? I mean, would we be going just straight to Mars or what exactly?
Well, there's a couple of big concerns that I think a lot of people in the space policy community have. One is that you're still going to the moon, but you're not doing it in 2024. You're pushing it out to 2028. And it's really an Apollo-style return in the sense that it's flags and footprints. Astronauts go down on the surface for a day or two, then they come back, and then that's it. And then sort of supposedly from that, we're going to go on to Mars. And as a matter of fact, the House bill specifically prohibits the in-situ resource utilization that you and I just talked about, you know, going to the poles and seeing about that water ice that's there. The other problem is it kind of puts NASA's eggs all in one basket. It tells NASA that you've got to go to the moon using this big Boeing rocket, the Space Launch System. You've got to use their upper stage, the exploration upper stage, and you've got to use an integrated lander, which, oh, by the way, Boeing is the only company that has proposed to NASA to build that.
Let me ask this question that may sound cynical. Why is this happening? Is this the result of lobbying from Boeing?
It's hard to say for sure, but that seems like the most reasonable read on this, is that Boeing has been pushing this plan and that a number of people in the House have bought it.
Eric Berger is senior space editor for Ars Technica. Read all about it. We'll have a link to it at texasstandard.org. Eric, thanks again.
My pleasure, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
I'm Alex Dormont, the band leader of the Hot Texas Swing Band. I've been playing the dance halls for 40 years, ever since I got to Texas. So, I have the best seat in the house there up on the stage. See all the couples go by with smiles on their faces. I like to dance too, so my wife and I go out dancing when I'm not playing. And it's good to be a dancing musician, because then you know what beats work best and everything. But you kind of sense, as a band leader, I call the tunes, you know, I sense what the crowd wants next. Well, they want a shuffle now, or they're hungry for a waltz, you know, so you want to keep the audience happy. Oh, it just got that feeling, you know, it's like a jazz and country music put together. And it's just got so much spirit and layers of complexity. Texas Swing, it's just got a life force, you know, that I really like. But with subtlety, you know, like rock music kind of hits you in the chest, and swing music makes you want to tap your foot and move. Hi, I'm Alex Dormont from the Hot Texas Swing Band, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Coming up on 42 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time, I'm David Brown. The story most of us have heard about family separations at the border has been one of immigrant parents apprehended by U.S. border authorities and detained in facilities separate from those of their children. The policy was officially ended in mid-2018, but there is another ongoing story of family separation involving immigration policy, this one receiving far less attention. The Standard's own Joy Diaz reports.
The story of the Angel family of Central Texas includes a detention, a deportation, a kidnapping, and an illegal return into the United States. As you can imagine, all of that caused a lot of stress and periods of depression. One more thing. We'll be using first names only for this story because of the family's very real fear of another deportation. The dad in this story is Angel.
Angel.
It means angel. That's his real name. He's 29 and he's from Mexico. His wife, Rosie, is 24.
Ella es ciudadana americana.
She's an American, a Texan. And they have three kids.
Tres niños.
All born here. Three little Texans, ages 8, 5, and 2.
The meals!
She likes the moons because she wants to be an astronaut.
I met the kids and Rosie on a foggy morning as they drove to school. Our conversations were a mix of English and Spanish, a common thing for mixed status families. If you're not familiar with the term, mixed status, listen to Dr. William Lopez, a researcher at the University of Michigan School of Public Health.
A mixed status family is a family that varies in immigration statuses, and usually that means an undocumented parent of citizen children.
The mixed status comes with its own stressors. After Rosie drops off the kids, she heads into work. As we drive, she tells me she's the manager of a health clinic in Austin. For his part, Angel supervises a construction crew. He uses a fake ID to work, and that's at the root of his deportation last year, the fake ID. One morning in early 2019, Angel got pulled over. He presented the officer with his fake papers and was immediately detained on immigration charges. When the two oldest children came home from school that day, they learned Dad wasn't coming home. Again, Dr. Lopez.
You can imagine growing up with this fear that every time your dad or your mother drives away, that might be the last time you see them. It's not hard to imagine how damaging that can be for a child psychologically.
To add to it, Angel spent 6 months in detention. The impact to the children was obvious to Angel and Rosie. Visits were through a glass window.
They're all crying because they see him and saying they want to hug him and they can, because you can even touch him.
Then,
me deportaron a México, ¿verdad?
Angel was deported back to Mexico. In 2018, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security removed more than 400,000 people from the United States. Angel's deportation, however, wasn't the end of the story.
Y me secuestraron.
Shortly after being dropped in Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, Angel was kidnapped, a ploy used by many Mexican cartels that's on the rise. They target migrants thought to have relatives in the United States and hold them until ransom is paid. Now, Rosie was not only dealing with the children on her own, she was being harassed by kidnappers who wanted thousands of dollars for Angel's release.
And they told me, we need this, if not, you're not going to see him again.
Rosie drove to Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, to deliver the money.
I was scared. I had my three kids with me that day. So I was just crying and crying like everyone was seeing. I'm like, I wanted to stop crying, but I couldn't.
The kids couldn't stop crying either. They had spent the entire day in the car. They were hungry, tired.
Stressful, most of all. Painful.
Angel knew his wife didn't have enough money, and he got word to her not to pay. Rosie ended up turning the car around and going home, even though she knew her husband could be killed. But that, she told me, was beyond her control. Instead, she tried to focus on what she could control, which was her kids' well-being. When people ask her, why doesn't Angel become a citizen? She has to tell them it's almost impossible because he had originally entered the U.S. illegally. It doesn't matter that he's married to an American or that he has American children. Meanwhile, in Mexico, Angel went through his own ordeal. He escaped his kidnappers and took refuge in a church. From there, he was able to call his boss back in Texas and told him the whole story. He also told his boss he wanted to come home, but he needed money to hire a coyote, a smuggler, to get him back into the U.S.
Ahora anda rondando los $10,000.
It was around $10,000. His boss lent him the money and even promised him his job back if he made it. Rosie couldn't believe it.
It was like I was basically dreaming. It was just unreal.
After the call, Angel was nervous and didn't know what to expect upon his return. Would Rosie still be waiting for him? What if she had met someone else? After all, it had been almost a full year since they had seen each other. They barely talked in that time. But the sound of the church bells calmed him down. They brought memories of their wedding day and of the words their minister said.
Lo que unió Dios no lo separa del hombre.
Let no one separate what God has joined together. It is against the law to cross the border without documentation, but Angel felt no law could separate him from his children. The family is together, again, but not without scars, especially the children.
They've been through a lot. They're not going to forget this.
I'm Joy Diaz for the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
Got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. On Monday, the Texas Democratic Party and the Texas House Democratic Campaign Committee released their plan to target 22 state House seats come November. The party's end goal, well, to flip the Texas House from red to blue, to be candid. So what seats do Democrats see in play? For more on that, we're joined by Texas Tribune political reporter Patrick Svitek. Patrick, welcome back to the Standard.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Back in the 2018 midterms, Democrats picked up 12 state House seats. How many would they need this year if they wanted to really flip control of the House?
Well, they need to defend those 12 seats that they picked up, and the Republicans are seriously targeting those seats in November of 2020. But they are effectively 9 seats away from the majority at this moment, and so they would need to defend those 12 seats and then pick up 9 seats in addition to that.
Okay, so are they going to be able to keep those 2018 wins? I mean, you mentioned that the Republicans are trying to chip away at it.
You know, some of those 12 seats are going to be much closer races, or were much closer races last time than some of the other ones. Some of those were some pretty decisive victories in seats that are really trending away from the Republicans. But there are certainly, among those 12 seats that flipped, there are a handful where Republicans have a decent shot of flipping them back in 2020, depending on which candidates emerge from their primaries and depending on how hard they work and organize and get themselves funded during the general election. So in those 12 seats, I think there are going to be, in as many as half of them, some real battles.
Well, no, you are, I'm sure, aware that Beto O'Rourke, the former presidential candidate and one-time senatorial candidate, too, launched a group specifically for the purposes of taking on some of these state House seats. But he's far from the first one to do so. I'm thinking the Obama campaign veterans who launched Battleground Texas a few years back. Do you think O'Rourke has a chance to move the needle in ways that others haven't, perhaps, or no?
Yeah, I think he does. I mean, I think what he's trying to do here is kind of reactivate the volunteers and organizers that helped get him so close to beating Ted Cruz in 2018. And among some of those supporters and volunteers and organizers, you know, he's a uniquely galvanizing figure. He is someone who people obviously connected with very well during the 2018 campaign. And he was able to, I think, bring out some of these new voters and get some of these independent and maybe even Republican-leaning voters in some of these battleground areas in his 2018 Senate run. And so this, you know, is really going to be a cycle to see kind of where his political brand stands 2 years later. As you pointed out, he's launched this new group powered by people, and he's planning to help candidates up and down the ballot. But you're right, his number one political focus, he said, this cycle is flipping the Texas House. And so I expect him to be heavily engaged in that fight.
So what are the battleground areas? I mean, I recall after 2018, the Republicans wringing their hands over a loss of some of the suburbs in Dallas, and I think in Harris County out Houston way, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these battleground races are playing out in suburban or a mixture of suburban and urban districts in places like the Houston area, in places like the Dallas-Fort Worth area, even in places outside of Austin and the Austin suburbs. I mean, those are really the three, if I had to list them, the three main target areas, both for races where Republicans are trying to flip back seats they lost last cycle and for places where Democrats are trying to make further inroads. and flip Republican seats in their favor. And we've seen that all across, you know, this is into a national trend all across the country, of especially under Donald Trump, you know, the suburban areas, even in red states or even in reliably red regions, kind of slipping away from Republicans, and that becoming kind of the new battleground. And so we're definitely seeing that fight play out on the state level here when it comes to these Texas House races.
A lot of people in Texas and way beyond taking a close look at what's happening in the Texas House of Representatives. Patrick Svitek continues to monitor things as political reporter for the Texas Tribune. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Patrick, thanks for joining us again. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, Dunbar is back in the studio, our social media editor, monitoring what Texans are talking about on this Tuesday. What you seeing?
Hey, David. Well, we just heard how Texas Democrats are targeting nearly two dozen Republican seats in the Texas legislature, and we are hearing about it from our friends and listeners on our Facebook page. Dallas Hall says there shouldn't be a single uncontested election, period. And Timothy Lyon says it's an exciting time to be a Democrat in Texas. Just an exciting time for Texas politics in general, I might add there, as we're seeing by the sort of momentum that's percolating out there. Well, another story that's sparking a lot of talk, the controversy over American Dirt. We talked about this earlier in the program. Released with a splashy rollout and tap for Oprah's book club, American Dirt. That story follows a woman fleeing Mexican narcos, and it's been positioned as a blockbuster, but its author IDing as partially white, and also these questions of whether or not the book exploits Mexican and Mexican-American trauma. So we heard that interview with McAllen Public Library, the library director there, how they backed out of this promotional program with Oprah after learning that American Dirt was the pick. So hearing from lots of folks about the controversy surrounding this novel. Via Twitter, Aida Gulen-Cozy says, "Good for McAllen's library. The book is really a mess, and I'm disappointed in it from concept to publication push." However, Cindy Danshaw, also via Twitter, she says that McAllen's library is exercising a form of censorship. Let patrons decide by checking out the books or not checking out the books. I believe the book is not censored, is still available, but just this big promotional program they had scheduled has been canceled.
That is
many
correct,
more
sir.
Takes, yeah, many more takes out there on our Facebook page. Erica Sanchez Zertuche, she says, the issue is not the story, or rather, the issue is the story, has been told by Mexican and Chicano authors, but don't receive the same support from publishers. This story is about more than the author. It's about the institutional racism of the literary world.
The publishing industry, I think, is something that a lot of people are pointing out. And frankly, the way that, you know, the outsized influence that Oprah and her book club can have on the industry, and the way that the marketing is sort of centered around Oprah's book club. You know, what I found rather interesting was that the publisher, apparently, and Oprah's book club had targeted these institutions in the southwest of the United States, in quotation marks, southwestern United States. And they were clearly trying to take advantage of the fact that we're talking about places where there might be a lot of...
places on the border like McAllen.
Yeah, exactly,
Yeah, fascinating stuff. I'm sure we'll link to it in the build-out on our webpage at texasstandard.org, but this fascinating op-ed in the New York Times that delves into some of these issues, and they talk about how, just the outsized influence of Oprah's book club, and it basically cannibalizes sales of other adult books because there's so much emphasis on the one book that has been pushed. So really fascinating story with a lot of aspects that we're getting into there.
And it is an op-ed. So, your mileage may vary, as they say. Hey, listen, we would love to know what's making news in your part of Texas, as always. And you know what to do, right? You just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. And as always, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, is a-looking for you. The news continues over at texasstandard.org. Where you can get links to the original versions of many of the stories we've been talking about on The Standard today. We're going to be back on the radio tomorrow, and we hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard crew, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.